a local bicycle food delivery company delivering to the Portland metro area in an hour or less. More information and a list of local eateries they work with can be found at pdxccc.com.
You're smiling, shining, beaming like the sunshine, rising, climbing, grinding through the hard times, growing, showing up like you're a star. Cause no matter where you stand today, I hope you know you are, hope you know you're worthy of that smile on your face. Know you're worthy, keep on flowing in your grace. Know you're worthy to take up all that space.
You're listening to X-Ray FM, KXRY Portland at 91.1 FM, K296 FT West Haven, serving Portland at 107.1 FM, and K219 KU Nehalem, serving Nehalem, Manzanita, and Rockaway Beach at 91.7 FM. Streaming live and archived at xray.fm, radio is yours.
Welcome to Sprouts, Radio from the Grassroots, a weekly program that showcases radio production by independent community media. We bring local stories to a global audience, produced at a different location every week.
One farmer commented that he grew up having access to the Wapsipinicon River as a young person, fishing and after hard days work on the farm and so on to go and relax. But he said, you know, I didn't think in that time about where that water was coming from or where it was going. But now he does.
Today on Sprouts, the Mississippi Watershed, Connecting Water and People. I'm Ursula Rudenberg from Pacifica Network.
And I'm Stephanie Schubert from Pacifica Network. We are reporting from the Iowa Nature Summit in Des Moines, Iowa. This conference took place at Drake University in October of 2023. It's a gathering of farmers and environmentalists throughout the state of Iowa. We were at the conference with a grant from the Be Wild, Rewild program, a group of Iowans with a passion for wildness, whose motto is Big River Connectivity. What does Big River Connectivity mean? The Be Wild, Rewild program is specifically talking about the connections in the Mississippi watershed, rivers, wetlands, natural areas, and the people who care about them.
As we interviewed conference goers, we met environmentalists who, in their work, take meaning from Iowa's place in the Mississippi watershed.
So, why the Mississippi watershed?
Well, have you ever actually seen a map of the Mississippi watershed? It's huge, covering 40% of the continental United States, which really brings the vision of Big River Connectivity to life. We start today's show with a conversation about a documentary film sponsored by the Be Wild, Rewild program. The film is called Moved by Waters, produced by the Emmy Award-winning Fourth Wall Films, and is featured at the conference. Mark Edwards from the Be Wild, Rewild program and Kelly Rundle, the film co-director, speak with me before the showing. Here's Kelly.
My wife Tammy and I own and operate Fourth Wall Films, and we're based in Moline, Illinois, on the Mississippi River. We're excited about Moved by Waters. The premise was to show people, setting aside differences they might have, who were all working on water quality issues. When we did our initial research, we felt like we were uncovering a secret network of people and organizations who were all working, doing everything from individual choice to much bigger projects, working the rivers in the region in terms of big cleanup operations, you know, millions of pounds of trash, and an evaluation process, testing water quality, capturing specimens to determine what fish species are thriving in a particular creek, what water bugs or what they call macroinvertebrates, to find out what's the water quality like. And then data gets fed to cities and to county organizations as they make decisions about what to do and how to improve water quality generally.
Do you incorporate a sense of the power of wildness when you did this movie?
Yeah, of course. That was context for it. And the great cities of the world are all situated on bodies of water, you know. And that's how I feel about the Quad Cities. It wouldn't be the city it is and have the beauty and power that it does without one of the great rivers of the world flowing through it. You know, I grew up at a time when the Mississippi River was regarded as kind of treacherous and polluted. But when we returned to the Quad Cities 25 years later, it's cleaner. One indication of that was the great white pelican, which was never there when I was growing up. And that's an indication of, you know, a lot of fish and we have eagles, more eagles than we can count. It's just great to see things headed kind of in the right direction for that incredible landmark that we're lucky enough to live near.
What did you gain from seeing all the work that these people are doing?
Yeah, the national narrative is that we don't agree on anything and we can't get along and we can't get anything done. And that's not true. Especially those things are kind of universally necessary for all of us to live and to have a quality to our life. But what you see in the film is just a little bit of what's happening. There's a lot of it. And I think the reason we don't know about it is because these people are workhorses. They're not show horses. So I think the film will just model a lot of ways that people can do something, whether it's individually with choices that we can make, or if it's joining with others who are working on an important water quality project. I hope so, anyway. One farmer commented that he grew up having access to the Wapsipinicon River as a young person, fishing and after hard days work on the farm and so on to go and relax. But he said, you know, I didn't think in that time about where that water was coming from or where it was going. But now he does. And just knowing your place in a watershed, you know, gives those things that you might do to improve it meaning.
I'm hearing a parallel between the connectivity of the rivers and the water and the connections people are making with each other. Mark Edwards, your thoughts?
I think the watershed concept really illustrates a larger vision of our place and where we live. You know, it's like little tributaries getting to a bigger watershed. If we really understood our place in that river, we would just relate a lot differently to that water. I think that's hard to think that way in a way, but another way, it gives you a sense of your place, like you're just this little water drop moving through, you know, and I think that helps me getting deeper into my relationship to where I live. We always look at it from what are we going to get in terms of recreation, or let's do something to the river for transportation, or let's do something for the railroad to be there along the side, or it's all that kind of human thing. But I'm not sure that really helps us to think that way. You know, and we look at the river from a human perspective, but the river has its own life.
This is Stephanie Schubert for Pacifica Radio, reporting from the Iowa Nature Summit in Des Moines, Iowa. That was Mark Edwards from the Be Wild, Rewild program, together with Kelly Rundle, co-director and co-producer of the award-winning production company Fourth Wall Films. Kelly is at this conference to show Moved by Waters, a film he made with his partner, Tammy Rundle. You can see the film and other works by Fourth Wall Films at www.bewildrewild.org. Moved by Waters is sponsored and being presented at the conference by the Be Wild Rewild program. After the first showing of the film, Ursula Rudenberg and I speak with Roger Gipple, co-founder of the Be Wild Rewild program, to get a better understanding of their vision.
Be Wild Rewild is just a loosely knit group of volunteers with a passion for wildness. When I started doing this work, we called it Wild Iowa Discovery because we were thinking about rewilding in Iowa. But I realized we have to talk about the watershed. I was talking with Joe McGovern. We were having lunch. He's with the Iowa Natural Heritage Foundation, and he mentioned that we can't stop at the county line. And I got to thinking, and we can't stop at the state line either. And so I looked at the watershed, and I realized this is a huge watershed. It's parts of 32 states. It's 40% of the country. So all of a sudden, it became pretty overwhelming to me. The Mississippi River watershed is one of the largest watersheds in the world. And if you look at Iowa, we're right in the middle of it. And Iowa is an important part of the problem that's being faced by those who live downstream, all the way to the Gulf of Mexico and into the Gulf of Mexico. We're dumping a lot of junk downstream.
Ross, you used the term big river connectivity. Explain that.
Well, big river connectivity is our vision for how we can create a wilder, more beautiful, more biologically diverse, and a more enduring Mississippi River watershed. So when I look at the Midwest, I see great potential for connectivity. It's a matter of we need to provide more core habitat areas, allow more habitat along the rivers, have corridors to connect those core habitat areas.
When you say corridors, is that like paths for animals that can go around highways, or what are examples of corridors?
So first you'd have the core habitat areas, which would be a geographical area that had the right kind of habitat for a diverse population of wild things to have healthy breeding populations. Then you need corridors where you allow critters to move back and forth instead of having a situation where they're all related and you get inbreeding. And then we need crossings at human transportation routes, and we need to be more willing to coexist with things that are not necessarily predictable and familiar to us. And I say that a big part of understanding wildness is understanding that it is unpredictable and unfamiliar.
So are you interested in connecting with other states that are part of this circle of rewilding? Who would you talk with to keep this process going?
We would talk with anyone who is interested in wildness, in rewilding, and who's interested in a more sustainable, enduring agriculture.
This is Stephanie Schubert for Pacifica Radio, together with Ursula Rudenberg, reporting from the Iowa Nature Summit in Des Moines, Iowa. At this conference, we end up speaking to many people in the hallways and discover a legacy of environmentalists and career conservationists who, over the years, have, indeed, championed the natural world and made a real difference. One of these is Doug Haar, a certified wildlife biologist. Doug worked for the Iowa Department of Natural Resources in Des Moines as coordinator for the Wildlife Diversity Program, which helped repopulate Iowa with animal species that had once been considered extinct to the area. Since his retirement from the DNR, he serves as president of the Iowa Audubon Society, so today his focus is mostly on birds.
You had a conversation with Roger, so you know a little bit what his vision is for building a network of wild areas?
Yes, these connection of wild areas is very important, whether they're hunted or whether they're sanctuaries. But the important thing is to connect all those habitats. There's some western states that are doing that. We need to do that in Iowa. We've got major river corridors we can connect with that are great places for birds and for other kinds of wildlife as well. And now that I'm with Audubon, certainly bird sanctuaries are something that we are really looking into as important too. By connecting all these areas, we have ways that the wildlife can move from area to area and help preserve them over time.
Why is it important to do this in the first place?
Well, when areas are disturbed by a lot of use, whether it's by vehicles or farming, hunting, fishing, whatever it might be, then some of the birds that should be nesting or things that should be living in Iowa, they may move away. They may not be able to reproduce and keep their population stable or growing. I mean, so many things disappeared because of what we did to the environment of this state. And we really have to think about the migratory birds, because so many birds have decreased by almost a third since the 1970s. And it wasn't that we in DNR weren't trying to protect all of them. But of course, so much of the habitat was getting disconnected by more and more development, more and more farming. And so it's really just so important that we try to connect all those areas as best as we can everywhere.
Can you talk a little bit about birds and water in Iowa?
There was so much drainage in Iowa from before the turn of the 19th and the 20th century. A lot of drainage started, and then through the 50s, 60s, 70s, so many wetlands were drained. And so we lost tons of water birds. We lost tons of ducks. We lost some rare shorebirds that people didn't know used to nest in Iowa. Now they just realize they nest up in Canada and places like that. But the fact is that since the late 1980s, Iowa DNR and many of the county conservation boards, with assistance from the U.S. Fish and Wildlife Service, we've been able to start restoring many, many wetlands in the state. And that's bringing water birds back to Iowa. So we're seeing more and more ducks nesting in Iowa. We're actually seeing some rare shorebirds nesting in Iowa. And certainly using these wetlands and marshes and lakes for big migrating stopover points.
I think a lot of times when people think of water, they think of rivers and lakes, but you're saying the wetlands.
Every kind of water we have in Iowa, whether it's a lake, whether it's a marsh of some sort, whether it's rivers or small streams, they're just all so important to so many types of aquatic birds, yes. Once we can work with farmers and make them understand more about how they can farm the way they want to raise things, but still do a lot more to help wildlife and help clean our water. Yeah, farm those flat things that maybe aren't as important to wildlife as some of these marginal areas that we keep seeing plowed up and turned into farmland when they shouldn't be, because it's not great for production. It's not that great for the amount of production you get off those. It causes more water pollution problems, and it takes habitat away from wildlife. We need to realize how important Iowa is to our wildlife and natural resources, and protecting not only our water supplies, but the water supplies into the Mississippi River and the Gulf of Mexico. Yes.
Well, you know, we have this image of the geese going over.
Mark Edwards from Be Wild Rewild joined our conversation.
And there's the wildness and the sound and all that. And they've been going over lately a lot. Someone said, wow. You know, it's from a bird's view, we need to stretch our vision of what the world is. That's what we're kind of focusing on with the rewilding. And we felt like, you know, the East Coast and the West Coast has really focused on this for years. But they left out the whole Mississippi watershed, which is the bird place in the world, right? It's the biggest bird thing ever.
Yes, it absolutely is. The Mississippi Flyway is the largest bird migratory corridor in the United States. I mean, that's just how important it is. And you know, the birds, because they're flying, they see all the habitat below them. They know where they have to go. You know, if it's not here in Iowa, well, we're not going to stop there and you're not going to see us. That's what it gets down to.
Thank you, Doug. We really appreciate it.
Thank you.
You're listening to Sprouts, radio from the grassroots, a weekly program bringing you local radio productions of global interest. I'm Stephanie Schubert, along with Ursula Rudenberg from Pacifica Network. Today, we are talking about the Mississippi Watershed, a massive network of rivers flowing into the Mississippi. The network covers 40% of the United States. We began the program speaking with filmmaker Kelly Rundle about a film Kelly co-directed called Moved by Waters. The film follows people from different backgrounds who are all working to improve water quality. We also spoke with both Roger Ross Gipple and Mark Edwards from the Be Wild Rewild program about the meaning of Big River connectivity. This conversation is one of many we are reporting on from the first annual Iowa Nature Summit, where local farmers and environmentalists are coming together to learn more about preserving the diversity of their state. Veterans of the environmental profession, Pat Schlarbaum and Mark Edwards, both retired from the Department of Natural Resources, and retired restoration ecologist Lauren Lown, are talking about their legacy of implementing this concept of core areas for wildlife that are connected in central Iowa around the city of Des Moines. Mark Edwards begins by explaining how the Ledges State Park captivated him when he was young, when his family moved there from the big city.
We moved from urban kind of lifestyle into rural Iowa and loved it. I would keep over the weekends really comfortable out there alone, learning my plants and birds and what was around me. That was where it kind of started, and graduated from college, and I ended up by the Des Moines River in a little cabin, and I'm still by that river valley 50 years later going, wow, what a place. Just up the road was Ledges State Park, and it led to my career in the Department of Natural Resources and trying to protect that place, which I had even deeper love growing all the time. So it's been an interesting journey. Here I am today, still feeling the same way I did. You know, I live in the most biologically altered state in North America, and yet I can't think of living anywhere else. Being on the front line is probably the most important place anyone can be. I've given my life to understanding what that means.
The park where you mostly focus on was the Ledges State Park, which is along the Des Moines River in central Iowa.
Yeah, but I was running 6 and 7 crews across the state, and we were doing all kinds of ecosystem restoration, prairie management, that kind of stuff. And having visited Chautauqua area, it was a big thing for me.
Pat Schlarbaum, you worked for the Department of Natural Resources as well as Mark. You worked with the DNR's Wildlife Diversity Program, bringing back to Iowa various species of wild animals like bald eagles and the river otters.
Yeah, trumpeter swans and peregrine falcons and ospreys and sandhill cranes.
That's a really rich and beautiful legacy. In your work, you also saw the formation of Chautauqua Park near Des Moines.
Chautauqua is just a delightful place. It's in central Iowa on the Skunk River. Located in Polk County, the most populous county in Iowa. They've had a bond issue and made a choice to set tax money aside for wildlife. And that was a really astounding precedent. It's worth mentioning that the Chautauqua Wildlife Area is a county area, and there's another federal area just downstream called the Neil Smith Wildlife Refuge. It's all connected by the Skunk River, and we're linking a habitat associated with river corridors. And so we're trying to strengthen the corridors at every opportunity, because these big core areas of Chautauqua and Neil Smith Wildlife Refuge are such a gift.
What kind of land is Chautauqua Park? Is it forest or prairie?
River bottom. They call it riparian. There are marshes, heavily timbered, and they've attracted sandhill cranes. And we relocated the ornate box turtles, or threatened species here in Iowa, to Chautauqua. And now there's an area in Chautauqua that has ornate box turtles.
In my mind, it had always been potential of being better than any state park, because it's not a destination like a recreation area.
Mark Edwards.
You know, it's a wetland kind of thing. It's otters and kind of inaccessible, and people just didn't pay attention to it. The large core area they're trying to save for itself. Right? You know, I would paddle down these streams and start seeing the flow of the water in through places like this.
And that helped me lead to, you know, then looking at the watershed that it's set in and how do things connect and why is it so important as a bypass around Des Moines for a biological corridor so these species don't have to try to suffer through getting through downtown Des Moines to follow that river. And then that was where I met a lot of people. Lauren Lone was one of the first people that I could talk to about rewilding and core areas and corridors and all that kind of stuff, and he understood it. He knew rewilding. I mean, that was a big turning point for me to find other people that were thinking about the whole thing.
As a hydrologist, Lauren Lau understood water levels and potholes and rivers and all that sort of thing.
Patch Larbaum.
Great voice for the environment. And such a strong voice, not only for the environment, but for the people of Polk County. He was involved with a lot of the Chautauqua management decisions and talking with the farmers and working out agreements. And I'm sure he was very effective and yet cordial when it came to talking with the landowners to say, yeah, we'll sell our land to a conservation organization. And it's fantastic that now the citizens of Polk County have grown Chautauqua to over 9,000 acres now, and it continues to grow. And it is in the most populous county in Iowa.
Also, they moved the highway.
Mark Edwards.
They moved the highway.
How did you convince them to move a highway?
A lot of public hearing. There was a shoal of a wetland just up the road from Chautauqua called Engeldigger Marsh.
Patch Larbaum.
And back, I guess, in the 20s, there was a road that went right through the middle of it. Well, that's how the Iowa DOT would make straight roads. It went right through the marsh. It angled from Des Moines to Marshalltown. And then, lo and behold, it was time to change a two-lane road to a four-lane. And I believe it was a matter of 50 feet. Or they tried to diminish it by saying that, well, we need to widen the road, and we'll just widen the right-of-way. And there were those of us that felt that the incessant carving away of our natural resources was one of our great challenges in Iowa. And maybe we should realize that the road should never have gone through the middle of this jewel of a wetland to begin with. Well, that was taken to the DOT, and, you know, that was hard for them to get their mind wrapped around. And then that was taken to the people, and so there was a public outcry.
The DOT said that they were going to expand Highway 65 through Engeldigger Marsh and four-lane it from Marshalltown to Des Moines.
Lauren Lown.
Because it was an unsafe road, and yes, it was. It was terribly unsafe, especially where it took a huge dip and rise going through that marsh. I mean, there were car parts in the ditch everywhere. And we agreed they needed a new road, but they said, well, we're just going to four-lane through here. It's not going to hurt anything. They asked if there's anything significant. Well, yeah. And we pointed out that this is a perched wetland on top of a hill 100 feet above the rivers, and we don't know what's there, so we need to survey it. So they said, fine, we'll survey it. Former state ecologist and his wife did a survey at the DOT's expense. And at the end of the survey, his report started off saying, Engeldigger Marsh is a geological and ecological museum. 340 some species of plants, mammals, reptiles. That didn't quite do it. And then we finally found a state endangered species in the right of way. And that finally did it. And they moved the road.
And what was the species?
Poanes massasoit. The mulberry-winged skipper.
And what is that?
A little bitty butterfly. That was the final straw because, believe it or not, nobody builds a four-lane road without federal highway funds. And some of us knew about Section 4F of the Federal Highway Code that says that you shall not put a road through parkland unless there is no practicable alternative. And we proved that there was a practical alternative and that by putting the road there, it would harm state endangered species and biodiversity. And I think the federal highway just said, we're not funding it if you're going through there. They sided with nature.
So it was one of the first big, gigantic wins.
Mark Edwards.
Okay, we're going to get DOT to consider the biological integrity of a place is more important than moving that road over a little bit.
And it's a wonderful thing because it's a precedent.
Patch Larbaum.
And the people of Iowa are supporting these natural areas. And Be Wild, Rewild fits right in with their goals
habitat for wildlife as opposed to people. And corridors and core areas, well, Chichaco is a core area. So the corridor concept of linking Engeldinger Marsh with Chichaco is strengthening both areas.
Go out to Engeldinger Marsh and sit and listen for a while.
Lauren Laun.
And it's amazing. The more you look, the more you see. You'll hear frogs, yellow-headed blackbirds, sandhill cranes, sedge wrens. Listen to the bird song. Listen to white oak trees sing back to you. The last time I sat out there, one log in one place for 6 days. In the mornings only, I sat down. I counted 47 species of birds as I sat on that log. This is comfort, just sitting on a log. I had coyotes walk by me. I've had turkeys walk by me. I saw a bobcat. As a child, I was lucky enough I had a really calm mother. She used to take us out and make us sit down beside her on a log in the woods and stay silent for half an hour. My mother used to say, the birds will forget you're here after 15 minutes. Everything forgets you're here after half an hour. I think that's one of the biggest lessons of my life. And I think my work with natural resources taught me to move slowly, look carefully, and be cautious about what I do.
When you sit and you take the time to actually listen to all these things, what is the thought or the feeling that you get from that?
I still marvel at the diversity and the wonder that still surrounds us, that so many creatures can make it despite what we've done to them.
So you're saying that what you get is a sense of wonder?
Yeah, going home, a peacefulness. It makes me happy. I belong there. I think people forget that we're animals. Our nursery was the wild.
That's it for Sprouts. You have been listening to The Mississippi Watershed, Connecting Water and People. This program was made possible by a grant from the Be Wild, Rewild program. Representing this group today are Roger Ross-Gipple and Mark Edwards. More information about their work can be found at bewildrewild.org. Thanks to conservationists Pat Schlarbaum, Lauren Laun, and Doug Haar. Pat is retired from the Department of Natural Resources. Lauren is a retired restoration ecologist. And Doug is president of the Iowa Audubon Society. Thanks to Kelly Rundle from Fourth Wall Films, co-director and co-producer of the film Moved by Waters. More information can be found at fourthwallfilms.com. The first Iowa Nature Summit took place in October 2023 and was organized by Emeritus Professor of Law and founder of Drake University's Agricultural Law Center, Neil Hamilton. The summit was held at Drake University in Des Moines, Iowa. Information about the Iowa Nature Summits can be found at iowanature.org. We were the producers this week, Stephanie Schubert and myself, Ursula Rudenberg, from Pacifica Network. The Sprouts theme music is Torpedoes on Tuesday by Poison Control Center. Sprouts is a weekly program produced in collaboration with community radio stations and independent producers across the globe. The program is coordinated and distributed by Pacifica Radio. I am Ursula Rudenberg from Pacifica Network. Thank you for listening and see you next week on Sprouts.
You're listening to X-Ray FM. That's how intense this is. No. You're listening to X-Ray FM. Welcome to the Commons. We're your hosts. I am Julia Moore.
And I'm Hannah Francis.
The views and opinions expressed during the X-Ray AM morning show belong to us, the hosts, and do not represent the official policies or positions of X-Ray FM.
Any content provided by the DJs and commentators are not intended to offend any specific demographic, including religious groups, ethnic and cultural identities, club, organization, company, or individuals.
Hey, just a friendly reminder that you can text us here in the station. We will read it, most likely on air. You can text us here at the station at 971-220-5979. Thoughts, opinions, all the above.
Yeah, stay tuned. We've got a cool show coming up. We've got Jacob from Sunrise coming to talk about a shift in focus for the organization. That's going to be at 8 a.m. And then we're going to have some local news updates brought to you by us around 8:30, 8:40. And then we're going to have some local music. And until then, we'll have our Hearts Beat segment. And sorry that you may have missed us last week. Yeah. We were not here. I was sick. I was like hardcore sick.
Yeah, we were pretty down in the rep. But
yeah, thanks for tuning in.
If you tuned in, but we're back.
And I hope you had a great week. I hope you're not sick, but you know, if you are, you'll get through it. It's gonna be okay.
Yeah,
yeah. This one's a hard one. I don't know if I had the flu or what, but
yeah,
it was rough. I was out for like a week.
I have seen that the symptoms are like a tiny cough, which mm-hmm. I think is sad but cute.
A tiny cough?
Yeah, it's like,
maybe that is what I had. Because it was like a tickle at the back of my throat. I didn't even like have to cough necessarily, but every once in a while I was like,
yes, no, it's a tiny cough.
Okay, well, good to know. Keep that immune system boosted.
Yeah, kale.
What do you do for oranges. That?
Well,
kale and oranges.
Personally, I listen to what my body is asking from me, and mm-hmm. usually it's like kale, oranges, or like broth. It's pretty clear.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
Yeah. We should have a little health segment at some point.
Yeah.
But yeah, I think broth is good.
Sleep.
I think sleep is really important for me. That's like the main thing. I don't prioritize sleep a lot, and I'm working on that. I know I'm working on it, and I'm actually doing pretty good.
Good job.
But also like when I'm sick, I'm like, all right, I'm just gonna sleep, and if I'm not sleeping, I'm like knitting and watching Avatar, which I could not stop doing this week. It was insane.
Which season?
I'm on the third season. I'm like, you know, like that like trial period, like the period where Zuko like switches sides and he's like all conflicted and confused.
Yeah.
I'm loving it. That's great.
So good. Timeless.
It's so angsty.
It's so angsty and yet timeless.
But also wholesome.
And wholesome.
It's so funny how fast he switches sides. Like at the end. Like, you know, for the second time when he's like, never mind, I'm gonna be good, really, guys, and they're like, no, and there's like one episode of conflict and then immediately he's like their best friend.
yeah
that sounds nice. Okay, well, you know, this isn't an Avatar talk show, so
so we will be
we'll be right back. We're going to play you the Hearts Beat segment for this week, or potentially last week. I wouldn't know because I wasn't here. But I hope that you enjoy it, and we'll be back at 8 o'clock.
That's right.
And one more thing. The weather this week is actually rainy, which is exciting. I'm really into the seasons right now. No.
I'm trying to grow pumpkins right now.
Oh.
This is not the season for pumpkins. Late. I know.
So
I know, but I was really betting on this sun remaining around. Okay. I know, like, globally, we don't want that, but for my pumpkins,
okay,
I want that.
Do you have, like, a happy light or, like, you know, one of those?
It's outside. I can't.
Grow lights?
No.
Okay.
I bring the happy light of my smile to my pumpkins. That's it.
Well, good luck to your pumpkins.
Thank you.
And I hope everyone's enjoying the rain. All right, we'll be right back. Stay tuned.
Columbia Willamette, hosting Belonging Through Play, a series of summer camps providing kids with easy and safe opportunities for interacting with new kids and helping them build crucial friendships. Additional sports, enrichment, and full-day licensed camps are offered throughout the summer in the Portland-Vancouver area. Camp schedules and more information available at ymcacw.org/camps.
How has the writer's house been for both of you so far?
Oh, wow. I think I'm sold. Like, you know what? I love this place. I think I'll move here. And I just quickly texted my partner. I was like, I think I'm moving here because, like, the trees, there are trees everywhere. So I love that.
There's a kind of quiet here that lends itself to, like, focus.
Yeah.
And I feel like coming from LA, like, living sort of close to downtown, mm-hmm. I'm so used to, like, all this noise and, like,
yeah.
Blood pressure is up, heart rate is up, but here I'm like, oh, I can like exhale.
Mm-hmm. I moved here from California, so I used to live in Koreatown.
Yep. Mm-hmm.
Very close to
you. You know the T. Yeah.
And
It is.
How did you guys land where you landed?
LA is funny for me because LA was the first place that my family moved to when we moved to the US. Because my dad was finishing some degree there. But we lived in LA for like a few months. And then he got a job in Oklahoma, so we moved east and then got a job in Virginia. Culturally, I feel at home there. Weather-wise, I feel at home there. And a bunch of my friends from like different parts of the world have just moved there, kind of. So it's like finding community has felt easier. Mm-hmm. Yeah, and like there's a lot of really great outlets for writers and creatives who just want to connect. How about you?
I was born, raised, lived most of my life in Ghana. Mm-hmm. I mean, technically, I moved to the U.S. like about less than 3 years.
Yeah.
But before then, I had done my undergrad and done like grad school in Ghana. Mm-hmm. Then came here, did grad school, most likely MFA in creative writing. Then now I'm doing the PhD in health communication. Mm-hmm. And so it's, I think for me, it's really writing that brought me here.
That's true.
Yeah. The year I applied, I had no plan of applying.
It's funny, my journey to writing is kind of similar. I remember the day I was like the good immigrant child that I was. Mm-hmm. I was going to do a sensible degree.
Yeah.
I started off doing business management.
Yeah.
And then it was like my sophomore year of college. I was sitting in like a stats course. I'm like, I hate it. Great lecture.
Yeah.
I was sitting with like two of like my college friends who were also doing business, and they enjoyed the one I did. Like, I dropped the class during the lecture, and I changed my major during that lecture.
Wow.
And it was crazy. I didn't tell my parents. Until the semester before graduation, I didn't tell them.
Wow.
It was some tea. But I feel like I was able to get around it because I told myself, oh, you know what? I'm going to be a professor. Mm-hmm. Right.
Yeah.
And that like made it lessened the like blow. Mm-hmm. But it was similar. I was just like, this isn't for me.
Yeah.
You know, it's like, I'm tired of living for someone else's truth when like, I know I'm good at this and I like doing this. It was literally like in that moment, I was like, no, I'd rather be writing.
Yeah.
And I was lucky because my undergrad had a really good poetry program. Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. Like Rita Dove was teaching there. Uh-huh. And like my 19-year-old self was like, dear Professor Dove, I'm an aspiring da da da. And she met with me.
Wow.
I wasn't even her like student. She met with me and like she told me some books to buy, and like eventually I took her class like when I was like a junior or like senior. But having people like that and having black professors, having black writing professors showed me that it was possible.
I think for me it was slightly different. Mm-hmm. It was partly that, but also I loved the work that I was doing in health, public health. I love the ideas of public health because I felt like the same thing that I was exploring in my work in public health is the same thing that I explore in my work in creative writing. Mm-hmm. Yes, I mean, I was in an undergrad class and I was writing my poems.
Mm-hmm.
And so some of my colleagues knew.
Right.
And I remember...
Like writing poems like during class.
Yeah.
Instead of taking notes.
Yeah, I will be writing poems during class. One of my friends, he actually lives in California now.
Oh, wow.
Yeah. We were exchanging notes on paper. Like, and then he was like, bro, maybe you're not in the right place.
We can all see you writing something.
You know, maybe you should be at like, because my school was like solely a health university. The University of Health and Allied Sciences. Yeah. So everything was about health.
Yeah.
Right. And actually, the truth is that what I wanted to do was to write a poetry collection about health.
Mm-hmm.
Currently, my PhD dissertation actually does part of that work that I wanted to do as an undergrad.
Right.
I'm working with some archives and some of the things that I'm doing now. Mm-hmm. I'm more concerned with black health and especially medical mistrust, syphilis in the Negro male, and which often people refer to as the Tuskegee syphilis study, which is also a very wrong title because it takes the burden off the U.S. public health service or the government and then puts it on Tuskegee. The people of Tuskegee.
Yeah.
You know, and so some of the work that I'm trying to do now is to, you know, write poems about that using archival materials.
It's really clear in your writing that you're discussing how this culture of distrust this like really, really relevant culture of distrust. Mm-hmm. And I've
and that was the main thing of the study. Yeah. We are waiting to see how syphilis turns out in these men if we don't treat them. We forget that some of these men were married.
Yeah.
And so their wives, some of their wives, about 40 of their wives were infected.
Mm-hmm. And then children.
And then the children that they had, some of, I think about 19 kids had congenital syphilis. Later on, some of my work is going to explore that aspect. It's a complicated history, but I think it's also important that we still have these conversations because I think, especially considering where we are in the U.S., you know, political system right now, the history is being erased and all of that. It is very important that we don't forget about these things.
Exactly.
It is very important that, like, we keep talking about them.
And I like the fact that your work is tying poetry into it. Mm-hmm. Like, that's, like, a medium that can reach a whole new audience.
Yeah.
Because it's, like, the more artistic mediums we have to sort of proliferate in, like, an issue, right? The more audience we can get.
Yeah.
Hopefully the more minds we can change as well. Yeah.
How is the archival material that you're reading making it into your work right now in your poems?
For some of them, I'm looking at, say, reports. And I'm trying to see how I can use, like, blackout or erasure as a poem to kind of like reveal what else I am seeing in these reports. Right. And so that's one of the things. And then the other part is also trying to use Cento.
I like
but
that.
I'm thinking of Cento as a collaborative work.
Cento form, when you a poem comprised usually it's like the end words of different previous poems, but like think of it like as a collage or mosaic of like
existing work.
You pull together.
And so I'm looking at it from a perspective that is multiple voices, multiple people, different people speaking in the same work. And I mean, I'm thinking about it because like in Black communities, like we are also very like communal, and so I'm like, this is what it means. So this is what this person says, this is what that person says. Like, why don't we bring it together?
Like, especially within like Black expressive culture, Black religious culture, there is an inherent polyvocality. There is an inherent call in a response. When you have something as nefarious as colonization or enslavement, you remove a link from ancestry. The story
is gone.
Is gone completely.
It's gone.
So I feel like my work is in a similar vein.
Absolutely.
I'm trying to resurrect something. But also it's like, it's not just resurrection. Like there's like, there's a resurrection and there's also like a transformation. It's like I'm calling back to the past through the present to imagine like
Santo
what... to imagine what a future can look like.
How does the role of joy and music and dance factor into your poetry?
I appreciate that question. One of our mutual friends, Akos, she said this line like 5 years ago that still sits with me today. She's like, people think that joy and despair are opposites, right? But she's like, oh, it's just, it's the same, it's on the continuum, right? Like there are emotions on like this like continuum of like self actualization, right? So for me, it's like when I was writing Saltwater, it was I was in the midst of despair, you know, like I was writing about Black Death, right? Which is something that Black writers, debut authors, most first books deal with death, in ways that it's like a social expectation, right? But I'll circle back to that. So I was writing about death in ways that for me were cathartic because this was like pre-George Floyd, but like post-Trayvon, post so many other like public lynchings. And I had experienced it in my own life, right? Like, I had been pulled over, like I was protesting, So I was like, I'm using the poetry as a way of calling out, right? But also of like the times that I couldn't speak, the times where I felt silence. I'm like, oh, y'all finna hear it in this work. But it gets to the point where it's like, oh my goodness, like it's getting a little too dark, right? But then to resurrect or to rescue myself from like from that place, I look to how our funerals are, right? We dance at funerals. So like there's a way that
we have fun.
We have fun, right? Like there's so many memes. It's like, oh, Black people 10 minutes after burying you, like there's people like than jamming, you know?
I mean, low-key, I think funerals are, like, sometimes more fun than weddings.
Yeah. No, high-key, depending, right? Mm-hmm. You know, and for me, it's like, the joy was, like, it wasn't just a balance. For me, it was, like, if I'm planting the despair, the goal is to get to a place of joy.
Mm-hmm.
And it also humanizes Black experience.
Yeah.
You know, I think that there's a way that people... Black joy is usually situated, we are so sad, therefore we must dance, mm-hmm. right? But I'm like, no, mm-hmm. it's like, it's a human thing. You experience sadness, you experience mm-hmm. joy, you experience so many things.
Yeah.
And it's not just as simple as like, because of my trauma,
mm-hmm.
I must therefore be happy,
yeah.
right? Because I feel like people heal in so many different ways,
mm-hmm.
right? And like, for me, joy is a vehicle towards healing.
Mm-hmm.
It doesn't always mean that you've healed through something,
mm-hmm.
but it's a vehicle towards healing. There's a kind of mourning mm-hmm. called melancholic mourning,
yeah.
right? And then there's a different kind of mourning that's like more Victorian.
Mm-hmm.
It's called heroic mourning.
Mm-hmm.
And like in the older sort of like British tradition,
yeah.
elegies were very formal. It's like you mourn this way after, at the end of the poem, release. Right,
mm.
but in the melancholic or in the blues mode, it's like, no, we're gonna sit in this, right? Like,
yeah.
like by the end of this poem, like it doesn't mean that I've achieved closure,
mm-hmm.
right? And people think about the blues as like, oh, we sing because we are sad, and after the end of the song, everybody's happy. No, it's like what we were saying earlier, it's bearing witness.
Yeah,
I was curious because listening to both of you read, you're mm-hmm. both talking about a lot of spiritual themes,
yeah.
and then it seems like you diverge in terms of like your religious backgrounds, perhaps. Is that true or?
Yeah, no, I love this question. Both my parents are preachers. So it's like, my therapist making so much money.
Because Teddy, you're talking about the Bible a lot more.
I do talk about the Bible a lot more.
I think that, well, my initial poetry was very like religious, like, but now, yeah, it's like in the sense of like a Negro spiritual,
mm-hmm.
as in like this faith will save us. Now mm-hmm. I'm like, I'm very irreverent
mm-hmm.
because like, and that's coming from my background as like Black studies,
mm-hmm.
which I think for me, we're both working in Black studies, but in
mm-hmm.
different realms.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
And the more I learn about the histories
mm-hmm.
of conversion,
yeah,
the more I question religion or Christianity.
Mm-hmm.
as a religion, and I see it more as a means to a colonial end.
Yeah.
When I'm thinking about Black music and like Black spirituality, right, like drumming,
mm-hmm.
right, which is a staple of so many Black churches, was illegal
mm-hmm.
in the Western Hemisphere.
Yeah, I was like, about this.
Jamaica, Barbados, after the Stonewall Rebellion, 1831, here in the US, Black people couldn't drum. Black churches couldn't have drums for a long
yeah.
time, right? But when drums come back, I'm like, drumming is the quintessential Afro-spiritual medium,
mm-hmm.
right? Even like in the new book that I'm writing, it's dedicated or it centers on the Yoruba Orisha Ayom,
mm-hmm.
which is the Orisha of wood
mm-hmm.
and drumming, right? Because I'm Yoruba on my dad's side. And the Yoruba believe that a drum will only repeat the sounds that it's heard,
mm-hmm.
right? So there's certain trees that are sacred to drums. Like these trees are only harvested for drums. When you harvest the tree, the last step in the drum making process, you leave the tree in different parts of the community to hear the sound of the language so that when it's time for the gods to speak, they'll be able to speak in the language that people understand, right?
Mm-hmm.
So there's this way that like drumming is so innately African, and drums were used as forms of communication in the Western Hemisphere, that once colonizers understood this,
mm-hmm.
drumming is banned. I would be so much more open to a kind of Christianity that is syncretic
mm-hmm.
and that appreciates the legacies of African spirituality,
mm-hmm.
right? But there's ways that the way that we were colonized, it demonizes anything
yeah.
that is inherently African.
This country has tried so much
mm-hmm.
for Black people in this country to not even get any education.
Mm-hmm.
Right. For us to be able to resist, to be able to write, to read,
mm-hmm.
to recite,
mm-hmm.
to, you know, speak up about some of these things in poetry.
Mm-hmm.
Right. That alone is resistant. One of the poems that I read, there's a line in it that my mom used to say.
Mm-hmm.
It's almost like, if you don't know how to fight,
mm-hmm.
sing the praise
mm.
of those who fight.
Mm-hmm.
Mm.
Right. And so in this moment, one of the mm. things that we can do is if you cannot fight in this moment, you can sing.
Up next, we've got Public News Service. Stay tuned for more.
The Public News Service Daily Newscast, November the 3rd, 2025. I'm Mike Clifford. Treasury Secretary Scott Bessent said on CNN's State of the Union Sunday that supplemental nutrition assistance program benefits, which impact roughly 42 million Americans, could resume as soon as Wednesday. That for Newsweek. The report on Friday, two federal judges ruled the administration must continue to pay the benefit with emergency funds. The delay in payouts is expected to leave millions of people without sufficient funds for their groceries. And from Axios, even if the Trump administration does comply with orders to ensure SNAP benefits are at least partially paid, it's still unclear when millions of families will actually receive their aid, and any relief would be just a temporary fix. Meantime, as the government shutdown in Washington enters its sixth week, Nebraska farmers are feeling the financial pinch. Many rely on farm loans that are being held up by departments that have been shuttered during the budget impasse that led to the closure.
Nebraska Farmers Union President John Hansen says the shutdown has added even more pressure on newer farmers because they can't access the federal Farm Service Agency loans they need to cover basic operating expenses.
Those producers that are the most vulnerable are those that have been in agriculture the shortest amount of time, which is about a fourth of all of the ag producers that have been in for less than 10 years. So they don't have as much equity and they have more operating debt to service.
Hansen says Nebraska farmers are already reeling from the effect of tariffs that have made their products harder to sell, and the government shutdown is adding additional pressure. Hansen adds that ag production costs have continued to rise, but commodity prices have remained steady or fallen, putting farmers' finances in a bind.
The input costs continue to go up year after year after year.
I'm Mark Moran.
And the largest network of reproductive health clinics serving rural Mainers has closed its primary care operations. That's due to Medicaid funding cuts.
A provision within the federal budget reconciliation bill passed earlier this year prohibits reimbursements for any provider whose services include abortion. Olivia Pennington with Maine Family Planning says more than half the network's patients live in remote areas already struggling with a health care shortage.
We have providers who see patients across generations of the same family. People trust us because we've earned their trust.
She says roughly 70% of patients rely exclusively on the network for their health care needs, with people already driving long distances for cancer screenings or wellness visits. The network will continue to provide reproductive health services through the use of grants and private donations. I'm Catherine Carley.
An ongoing lawsuit filed on Maine Family Planning's behalf asks for emergency relief so the network is not forced to turn away patients who rely on Medicaid and can't afford out-of-pocket costs. This is Public News Service. The 250th anniversary of the U.S. Postal Service is a milestone that predates the nation itself, and its advocates want to shine a light on its immense and often unseen workforce that delivers mail and packages to every American address.
The Miami-Dade County Mayor's Office is just one that has issued a proclamation recognizing the Postal Service. This comes as union leaders sound the alarm about renewed talks of privatizing the nation's mail delivery. Wanda Harris, who leads postal operations for a large region of South Florida, calls the agency a national treasure built for the people.
The challenges we're facing right now at hand, we're facing postal privatization, we're facing banning mail-in ballots. Just those two things alone can impact us to where the American people will be crushed. Because if we're privatized, of course, everything will be very much more expensive.
The first Trump administration supported changes that union leaders warned could lead toward privatization. And earlier this year, President Donald Trump said he was considering putting the service under control of the U.S. Commerce Department. I'm Tramell Gomes.
And as President Trump makes good on campaign promises to deport immigrants living in Colorado and across the U.S. without proper documentation, a new report spotlights the economic risk to Social Security and other programs that rely on payroll tax revenues.
As America's baby boomers continue to retire, the number of U.S.-born workers is expected to dramatically decrease over the next decade. Report author Josh Bivens says historically normal GDP growth rates will be impossible to maintain without immigrant workers.
It does make things like Social Security and Medicare a little harder to sustain. If we have a steady flow of younger immigrant workers coming in, that just makes it much easier to sustain those really important social insurance programs.
Medicare and Social Security are largely funded by today's workers, regardless of their immigration status, through payroll taxes. I'm Eric Galatas.
Finally, child poverty in Nevada hit 15% last year, 2 points higher than the national average. That's according to a new analysis by the N.E. Casey Foundation.
Researchers found that the national child poverty rate almost tripled from 5 to 13% between 2021 and